Now, sometimes you get what you ask for and more. I remember one time reading the story of a boy genius, obviously a fictitious story, by the way, of a boy genius who invented a way to transfer a person's personality into a dog. And so you could pretty well have a dog that with any personality you wanted. Well, there's this rich girl who thought she was perfect in every way, and she thought it would be perfect to have a dog just as perfect as she. And so she goes to this boy with her dog and says, "I want this dog to have my personality." Well, she's asking for something, is she not? She has a desire in mind. And so she makes this request, and he puts her and the dog in the machine and transfers her personality into the dog. And guess what she gives? A dog that's stuck up and spoiled and high maintenance, just like she is. And so she has this dog with this personality for a short period of time, and she obviously comes to a quick realization that this is a tough way to live. And so she looks around, and she has a friend who's very humble, very low maintenance, very commonsensical type person. And so she decides, well, I'd like to have a dog with this girl's personality. Trouble was, this girl was her arch rival for the affections of a particular boy. And so she takes this girl and the dog back to the genius and hooks them up to the machine, transfers her personality into the dog, and the dog comes out, again, what she thinks to be of a good caliber. She's not as high maintenance. She's not as uppity, not as spoiled. But then she's presented with a new problem because every time she tries to get near the boy, the dog attacks her. And so after a few more tries, she kept coming up with different personalities for this dog, and it never quite worked out. And the story eventually comes to a close. But I thought, well, that's a very unique way of looking at the idea that you get what you ask for. Because that girl got exactly what she asked for every time. And when you look at the books of 1 and 2 Samuel, you see a nation that in many ways suffered the same thing. Now, we're not going to go through every detail of both books tonight, because obviously that would be an impossible or difficult task. We do want to focus our attention tonight in 1 Samuel 8, because it's in 1 Samuel 8, I think, that we get a very general overview of the situation this nation is now getting themselves into. And it's this situation in which they're going to live for many, many centuries to come. And so tonight, as we look at 1 Samuel 8, we look at a nation who makes a very bad decision. God never, as we mentioned this morning in Bible class, intended Israel to be a monarchy. In other words, He never intended for Israel to necessarily have a human king, a physical king. However, Israel was faced with a problem because they saw many nations around them that were prospering. And all of these nations had one thing in common, and that was that they had a physical king. They had a physical king that would lead them, a king that would go before them and fight with them, a king to whom they could look up, and a king that would give them all of the law that the country over which he was reigning would need. However, as we said, God did not intend for Israel to be that way. Wherein God did not intend Israel to be a monarchy, He did desire and intend for them to be a theocracy. In other words, it was His intention as God to rule over them Himself. But as we come to 1 Samuel 8, we see Israel beginning to move away from that comfort. And in 1 Samuel, we are introduced in the first several chapters to a young man named Samuel. And obviously it's this man to whom these two books are attributed, at least by name, because they record, for the most part, the accounts of his life. And Samuel is brought by his mother Hannah to the high priest Eli after she had dedicated him to the service of God. And he is made to be a servant of Eli. And in the first several chapters, you see Samuel being called unto service by God. And he is made to become a prophet as well as a judge over Israel. And as being prophet and judge, Samuel was obviously one whom the people looked up to, one whom they went to, when they had a request or when they needed information. And so it was Samuel to whom they would go as they now began to transition into this particular section of their history. First of all, tonight, let's look at the demand that Israel makes unto God. And Israel, in making this demand, goes to Samuel. In 1 Samuel 8, 1 through 5, we find this demand. It came to pass that when Samuel was old, that he made his sons judges over Israel. Now the name of his firstborn was Joel, the name of his second was Abiah, and they were judges in Beersheba. And his sons walked not in his ways, but turned aside after lucre, and took bribes and perverted judgment. Then all the elders of Israel gathered themselves together, came to Samuel unto Ramah, and said unto him, Behold, thou art old, and thy sons walk not in thy ways, so make us a king. Well, you see the situation that Israel's faced with. Samuel, who has been their leader, has now become an old man. He has been a faithful and a righteous leader before the nation of Israel. But now, as he's gotten older, as the text indicates, he begins to delegate authority unto his sons. And so now, as Samuel is nearing the age in which he's no longer going to be among them, he is now trying to look forward to the future of Israel. And so he gives his sons authority over the nation. However, the problem was that these two sons were not as righteous as was Samuel. And so they would take money, they would take bribes, for the purpose of perverting judgment in any situation in which they could. And Israel was fed up with it. And they were looking toward the future as well. They knew Samuel was not going to be alive much longer. And they looked at their futures being bleak as long as these two men were in charge. And so they come to Samuel and they say, We want a king. We cannot trust our future to the decisions of these two men. And so we want a king. Well, that's their demand. They want a physical king. The problem was they forgot that all the while they did have a king. Not a king they could see. Not a king that sat on a physical throne. Not a king that would physically go before them and fight for them and fight with them. Not a physical king that would physically lead them, but nonetheless they had a king. They forgot that. And so they come to Samuel and make this demand. But look at what their reason is. And this was going to be the reason for Israel's downfall all throughout their history. You go all the way back to Exodus, and you overview their history until they were no more. Until the Jews were dispersed after the destruction of Jerusalem. The genealogies were destroyed. You go from their beginning to their end, and you look at any and every instance in which Israel fell for one reason or another, it all came down to this similar specified reason. And that was at the end of verse 5, they said, To judge us like all the nations. What was their desire? They wanted to be like everybody else. In other words, they wanted their society to conform to the societies all around them. Now, brethren, that's a problem that's still ongoing. Why is it that we have such a mass departure when it comes to religion? Because, for the most part, people want to be like everybody else around them. They don't see a need to be different any longer. Brethren, the Bible depicts New Testament Christians as a different people. And as long as our desire is to be like the nations around us, aka the religious bodies around us, we are going to suffer the same fate Israel did. And so let's take a lesson from Israel and realize there is motivation and benefits for being different from everybody around us. Their desire was they wanted to be judged like all the nations. Now, stepping back from this, we realize that Israel is viewing the other nations from the outside. They don't know everything that's going on in these nations. All they see are the results. They see other nations that are prospering. They see other nations that are doing well. economically. They see other nations that are faring well in other areas of life. They see all of the outside results without seeing what would be the turmoil in each one of them. And so based on the outer results, they desire that inwardly they want to be like everybody else. And so Israel's demand to Samuel, we want a king. And the reason we want this king is to be like everybody else around us. Well, based on Israel's demand to Samuel, we then see Samuel's and God's displeasure. Obviously, as we briefly mentioned this morning in Bible class, their request for a physical king is an outright rejection and denial of the God of heaven as their true king. They had a king all along. Why didn't they recognize it? Because they rejected him. And so now they are seeking after other kings, and Samuel and God are both very displeased. In 1 Samuel 8, 6, we see Samuel's displeasure. And the thing displeased Samuel when they said, "Give us a king to judge us." And Samuel prays unto the Lord. I like it that Samuel took this personally. Was Israel rejecting Samuel? No. In fact, in the next two verses, God is going to tell him that. Samuel, they're not rejecting you. They're rejecting me. But Samuel took a rejection of his God personally. And brethren, we need to do that as well. When the world rejects the God whom we serve, that should be a personal matter with us. And He is the God who has created us. He is the God who has sustained us. He is the God who has, through His infinite love and mercy, redeemed us. And ultimately, He is going to be the God who saves us. And when man rejects that all-loving, all-merciful God, then that should be a personal matter with us. Think about when you're a child and we perhaps would indulge in those childish activities of talking about each other or about each other's families. Did we not take that personally? Well, why then would we not take someone who is speaking out against or outrightly rejecting our God as a personal matter? Samuel was personally displeased in the fact that the nation of whom he was a part was rejecting the God whom he served. Brethren, we should take it personally when the world attacks and rejects the God whom we serve. But Samuel was not the only one displeased with their decision. Because in the next two verses, 7 and 8, we then see God's displeasure. And the Lord said unto Samuel, "Hearken unto the voice of the people in all that they say unto thee. For they have not rejected thee, but they have rejected me, that I should not reign over them, according to all the works which they have done since the day that I brought them up out of Egypt, even unto this day, wherewith they have forsaken me and served other gods, so do they also unto thee." What is God's tactic in dealing with this problem? He's going to give them what they ask for. I recorded a movie the other night, one of which I've read the book a number of times. Children's book, actually, but I have a childish mind, so I like to indulge in that at times. A book and a movie called Matilda. And in that book, there is a particular spot where in the school of which she's a part, obviously, there is a principal that is just a terrible woman. And there is a rather chubby child, and I can say that because I'm one myself, who snuck into the cafeteria one day and stole a piece of her private cake. And she didn't like that. Well, if you've read the book or seen the movie, you know what her response was. It wasn't to punish him in some way of taking him away from all pleasure of life. What did she do? She brought a whole cake, sat it down in front of him, and said, "Eat away, and you would eat every bite." What was her tactic? She gave him what he wanted, and more than he wanted. And that's exactly what God is doing unto Israel. Israel has asked for a king like all the other nations. What's God going to do? He's going to give them a king like every other nation. They're going to get what they ask for, but they are going to be sorely displeased in getting what they wanted. And so first of all, we see the demand. Israel makes a demand to Samuel, and then Samuel and God both show their displeasure in that demand. Number two, we then see in 1 Samuel 8 the warning. And the warning from God comes through a chain of command, if you will, because in process of getting that warning unto Israel, God first makes that warning to Samuel. In 1 Samuel 8, 9, he says, "Now therefore hearken unto their voice." In other words, give them what they want. They're asking for a king. They want to be judged like all the nations. Give them what they want, but protest solemnly unto them and show them the manner of the king that shall reign over them. Well, in the next several verses, we're going to read that solemn manner of protest. But let's stop here for a minute and focus on the fact that some people just can't be warned. There's some people you could talk until you're blue in the face, and you're about to pass out and trying to warn them about something, and they're just not going to listen to you. Well, Israel's that kind of people. They've been warned since day one when they came out of Egypt about idolatry, about the nations round about them, about following God or less the consequences of that. Israel could not be warned. From the day they came out of Egypt, they would reject warning. When they came to the very first obstacle that they faced after coming out of Egyptian bondage, what did they do? They blamed Moses for bringing them out of bondage to kill them in the wilderness and decided they wanted to go back to Egypt where they had the good life. They never could be warned. And now Samuel's going to warn them about this demand they've made, and they prove the fact that they still can't be warned. In untold generations of time between Exodus and now 1 Samuel 8, generation after generation, these people are just as dumb now as they were before. Brethren, let's learn from the mistakes of the past. We've had people before us who have made mistakes in the same way that we've made mistakes. But never let it be said that mistakes we allow to repeat. There are so many things that we can look back in the span of history and see that they did not work. And we can see the negative outcome of those particular events. And yet there are some people today who adamantly continue to try to do the same things they did years ago. They didn't work then, brethren, they're not going to work now, and they're not going to work in the future. And yet some people simply cannot be warned. Well, God is attempting to warn them, and Samuel is now going to attempt to warn them. And so just as God gave warning to Samuel, Samuel is now going to relay that warning to Israel. 1 Samuel 8, 10 through 18, Samuel told all the words of the Lord unto the people that asked him of a king. And now he says, "This will be the manner of the king that shall reign over you. He will take your sons and appoint them for himself, for his chariots, and to be his horsemen. And some shall run before his chariots. He will appoint them captains over thousands, captains over fifties, and will set them to ear his ground, and to reap his harvest, and to make instruments of war and instruments of his chariots. He will take your daughters to be confectionaries, to be cooks, to be bakers. He will take your fields and your vineyards and your olive yards, even the best of them, and give them to his servants. He will take the tenth of your seed and of your vineyards and give to his officers and to his servants. He will take your men servants and your maid servants and your goodliest young men and your asses and put them to his work. He will take the tenth of your sheep, and ye shall be his servants. And ye shall cry out in that day because of your king, which ye shall have chosen you. And the Lord will not hear you in that day." Now you look at everything Samuel says, this is going to happen. He's not saying this is a possibility. This is a distant outcome. He says this is absolutely, without doubt, positively what's going to happen based on your decision. You're going to lose your sons, you're going to lose your daughters, you're going to lose your harvest, you're going to lose your land, you're going to cry out unto God for forgiveness and redemption, and he's not going to hear you. Now you would think that anybody with any common sense after hearing that warning would step back and say, "Now wait a minute. Let's re-examine this situation. Do we really, really want a king that's going to do all this to us. What was their problem? Problem was they weren't looking toward the future, they were looking at the present. And they viewed these results as things that were probably going to happen years down the road that really weren't going to affect them. And so it's no hair off their back. Let's go ahead and make the decision. And then you see Israel's response. Verses 19 and 20. Nevertheless, the people refused to obey the voice of Samuel. Those are sad words in the history of Israel. Their refusal to obey and heed the warning of Samuel. But rather they say, "Nay, but we will have a king over us, that we may also be like all the nations, that our king may judge us and go out before us and fight our battles." They weren't looking toward the future. They weren't worried about the there and then. They were worried about the here and now. And so despite all the warning, despite all the caution, still they say, "Give us a king." And so Samuel now has a task before him. Verses 21 and 22, Samuel heard these words of the people. He rehearsed them in the ears of the Lord, and the Lord told Samuel, "Hearken unto their voice, and make them a king." And Samuel told the men of Israel, "Go ye every man unto his city. Give them what they ask for. And yet, let them realize they're going to get more than they asked for." Well, we've seen the demand, we've seen the warning. Now for our last few minutes together, let's look at the fulfillment of all of these matters that have been rehearsed thus far in 1 Samuel 8. First of all, you see Saul's part in this matter. You see, Israel thought perhaps that these were matters that were only going to come years down the road. And some of them did, and most of them did. But their decision affected them directly. Because wherein they thought these things would be reserved for future generations, God made sure that these people who made the decision personally suffered for their mistake. In 1 Samuel 14 and verse 52, there was a sore war against the Philistines all the days of Saul. And when Saul saw any strong man or any valiant man, he took him unto him. Well, is that not one of the warnings that Samuel gave to Israel? That he's going to take your sons, and he's going to make them soldiers, he's going to make them captains over hundreds and fifties, he's going to make them to prepare weapons of war and weapons for the chariots. Well, now in their lifetime and their generation, what happens? They enter into war with the Philistia, and things got so bad in the nation that in order to ensure victory, anytime Saul saw a man that was fit for battle, he didn't ask him, he didn't request that he volunteer to come to war, he took him. And he made him his own soldier without question. And so these people suffered personally for their mistake in rejecting the warning of Samuel and rejecting God as their king. But as we said, things did happen years down the road that would affect their later generations because of this decision. And so not only do we see Saul's part in this fulfillment, but secondly, we see Ahab's part. Ahab came along a few generations after Saul, after the kingdom had divided back in 1 Kings 12. And now Ahab is reigning over Israel. And Ahab perhaps is best known for his unrighteous wife, Jezebel. But in 1 Kings 21, 1 through 16, you find the record in which Ahab comes across a vineyard owned by a man named Naboth. And because Naboth's vineyard was close in vicinity to the home of Saul, and it was good and it was profitable, Saul made a request of Naboth that Naboth give Saul his land, and then Saul would then repay Naboth with a good land, a better land elsewhere. Well, Naboth rejected this because this was family land, and he wanted to keep it in his family. And we can understand that. In other words, to Naboth, there was no price big enough for him to sell this portion of his heritage. However, it was at this time that Jezebel, after learning of what Ahab had wanted, devises a very devious plan so that Ahab could come across this land that he so desperately desired. And so Naboth eventually, as a result of this, died. There were false accusations made about him. And based on those false accusations, Naboth was executed. And then after his death, notice what happens. It came to pass when Ahab heard that Naboth was dead, that Ahab rose up to go down to the vineyard of Naboth the Jezreelite to take possession of it. Well, was that, again, not a warning Samuel made to Israel? That this king that you decide to have rule over you is going to take of your land, he's going to take of your possession, he's going to take of your vineyards? He made the warning. And true to the word, it came to pass. Ahab took the land of Naboth, which should have gone to his children. And yet, based upon the bad decision of the Israelites, we see this coming to pass. And let it be said that when Saul took the young men to go to war, that wasn't the only time. When Ahab took the land of Naboth, that wasn't the only time. We're not talking about limited occasions in which these fulfillments came to pass. We're just giving examples of when they did. These things happened many times over throughout the history of Israel. And so we see these matters being dealt really tenfold upon the nation. But then number three, not only do we see Saul's part and Ahab's part, but a final example, of which certainly these things are not limited, we find in 2 Kings 25, captivity's part in the fulfillment of these promises Samuel made to the nation of Israel. The nation had been in a slow decline from the period in which they divided in 1 Kings 12. After Rehoboam, Solomon's son, came to power, and he promised further persecution upon the people, even than his father Solomon had done. Well, the northern tribes were not going to stand for that persecution placed upon them, so they revolt, elect Jeroboam to be their king. The nation divides into two. You have Judah as being the northern ten tribes, and Israel being the southern two tribes. And ever since that time, you're going to see this nation on a slow decline to utter oblivion. And it finally came to pass in 2 Kings 25 that after besieging and overcoming Jerusalem, Nebuchadnezzar, the king of Babylon, had Zedekiah and his sons brought before him. Zedekiah was the final king to reign in Israel after the lineage of David. And we see that as Jerusalem is taken, the nation comes to oblivion, that Nebuchadnezzar now has Zedekiah's sons put to death before Zedekiah's eyes, and then he puts out Zedekiah's eyes so that the last thing he ever saw in this life was his sons being killed. And after that, what became of the nation of Israel? Well, in 2 Kings 25:11, we read, "Now the rest of the people that were left in the city, and the fugitives that fell away to the king of Babylon with a remnant of the multitude, did Nebuzaradan, the captain of the guard, carry away." They go away into Babylon. They're there for 70 years before Ezra and Nehemiah ever bring them back. And so in that period of time, they in hundredfolds suffered the consequences of the decision of their forefathers. Well, Israel got what they asked for, and they got more. And wherein Israel made a sore mistake, and they had to suffer the consequences of that mistake, brethren, let it not be said that we make the same mistake that Israel made. Never let us decide that we want to be like those around us, not necessarily like the nations, but like the religious bodies. There's such a strong push nowadays, sadly, for so many congregations of the Lord's people who want to begin to expand their horizons, or broaden their horizons, if you will, and change things away from the old paths of the old Jerusalem gospel, and modernize and update religion. Brethren, if it was good enough in the first century, it's good enough for today, and it will be good enough for as long as time stands. And so let's not be like the nation of Israel making the decision. We want to be like the people around us. Understand the necessity and the benefit of being different. We are God's people. And if God be for us, who can be against us? Let us choose God and reject the world. And God will bless us for that. Tonight, if you're not a child of God, if you've not made that decision to put Christ on in baptism, to claim salvation to be your own because of the long suffering and mercy of God, do that tonight. Enter into this most heated battle that is so necessary to the growth of Christianity. And do it tonight by obeying the gospel of Jesus Christ. Become a Christian. Have your sins washed away. Be added to the church that's going to save your soul. Or tonight, if you are a Christian, yet you've not been in faithful service for some time because of a lifestyle of sin, tonight is your opportunity, maybe your last, to come back, to restore yourself to service unto God, to have your sins washed away once again, to make things right. Do that tonight. Make your calling and your election sure, as Peter said, and give yourself the blessed confidence that's found in Christ. Do it tonight. Do it now. While together we stand and sing.
Would you live for Jesus and be always pure and good? Would you walk with Him?